So we're going to be spending 6 weeks on the most popular writer in the Christian writer in the 20th century, C.S. Lewis. And if you're new to C.S. Lewis, I am so envious of you, because going into Lewis is such a treat. And it's like, you know, if this is your first time and you're just beginning to get exposed to Lewis, you are in a great spot. If you have been reading Lewis forever, do you want to teach? No, I'm just kidding. you're also in a good spot, because you're going to help us learn a lot as we go through this. And I just want to say that one of the reasons why Lewis has been so popular is there's so many on-ramps into Lewis. Lewis wrote so many different kinds of literature. It includes theology and philosophy and science fiction and fantasy and children's literature. He wrote poetry. He wrote literary theory and aesthetic history and Christian allegory and spiritual autobiography. He wrote fictional letters, and devotional meditations are some of the different genres. So there's something for you in Lewis, is kind of the message. And that's probably one of the reasons he's so popular. If you're not a philosophy head, you know, then there's, you know, maybe you'll like the literature. You know, it doesn't matter how old or young you are. If you're a child, Lewis has something for you. You know, if you're at the end of your life and you're dealing with grief, you know, he's got a book on dealing with grief. And so he kind of covers the gamut of our humanity in many ways. So, but he's probably best known as a Christian apologist. And so there's something appropriate about Paradox hosting this series on C.S. Lewis. And arguably, he is the most important apologist in the 20th century. But he wrote for the common man. And that's probably one of the reasons why we're all here. You know, if you write for people that are just so, if he would have just spent his whole academic career writing the high-level academic stuff, which he did write, I don't think he would have had anything like the response. And but like Wordsworth, he wrote in a way that invoked his lay readers, both wonder and enjoyment. So, and there's something beautiful about that. So before we get going, how are we doing, guys? Is this enough filler? 3 minutes. Okay, let's do this. Quick show of hands. How many of you are new to Lewis? Never read a Lewis book before? Wonderful. You folks are in a good spot. How many of you read 1 to 3 Lewis books? 1 to 3.
I remember him. I bought him
on CD. Okay. Probably most of the class. All right, how many of you have read... the Chronicles of Narnia, all of them. That's more than three. That's more than three books, okay? All right, how many of you read more than 10 Lewis books? Okay. All right, good. All right. So now you might think like, wow. But the reality is, if you read a science fiction trilogy and you read his Chronicles of Narnia, you're already in, you know, 10 deep. Right? And next thing you know, they're all gateway drugs, too. Like, it just takes one, you know, you just read this, you're like, well, wow, what did he write about this? And next thing you know, you're in. So I want to say a few things about how I'm coming to this. I'm not a Lewis scholar. I've been reading Lewis for 36 years. I've read about 25 of his books, which, again, it doesn't, you know, if you read the science fiction trilogy and the children's literature, you're already pretty far up. And they're small books. It's easy to just, you know, start digesting Lewis books. But I do consider Lewis one of my intellectual traveling companions throughout my life. I'm constantly returning to his work. I'm constantly returning to him. I'm constantly in dialogue in my mind, thinking. Sometimes you digest somebody to such a degree where they become a voice in your head, and you can start having conversations with them. Like, well, I wonder what he would say. You know, I'd say John Calvin's one of those people. C.S. Lewis is one of those people for me. Abraham Kuyper is one of those people for me. And the thing that's great about Lewis is he wrote so many classics that you can return to. A classic is a work that you can return to again and again. It just keeps feeding you. I also had the privilege of living in Oxford for a while. I was actually at Keble College, where Lewis was at. And I think he lived there as a freshman. And it's really close to Eagle and Child. So, what?
10 seconds.
All right, good. We're almost live here. Anyways, I was interested in pursuing a PhD in analytic philosophy at that time, and with Richard Swinburne. You probably know about Richard Swinburne, yeah. And but I remember this profound moment where I was sitting on St. Giles Street at about 11 o'clock at night, and I thought, I do not want to spend so much time in analytic philosophy. That just sounds like it'll crush my soul. I'm going to go back and be a pastor. So I dropped it at that time, and then the Lord allowed me to go back to school. So, but I did get a chance to be in Oxford and get to be able to see where Lewis was and his home. And if you're ever there, that's a wonderful treat as well. Okay, how will the class go? This is a six-week class. Today we're going to talk about Lewis the man. Next week we're going to talk about Lewis the theologian. Then we're going to do Lewis the ethicist. Then we're going to do Lewis the positive apologist, Lewis the negative apologist, and then finally we're going to end with Lewis the writer. We're going to come back to this at the end. I'm going to give you some prescriptions if you want to read at different levels. Some of you might want to read a book a week. Some of you might want a smaller chunk, and I'll give you some recommendations for that. But that's where we're going today, as we're going to be talking about Lewis the man. Lewis described himself as this way. He says, I'm tall, fat, rather bald, red-faced, double-chinned, black-haired, have a deep voice, and wear glasses for reading. That's what he wrote to an admiring fan, which shows you his humility. He usually dressed, his trousers usually needed to be ironed. His jacket was usually threadbare with some stains from some food. Had some blemishes and some snags. His shoes were scuffed and oftentimes worn to the heel. Basically like a typical Oxford don, really, right? He had a pipe. He liked to smoke a pipe. And why is this important? It's important because of who Lewis is. Lewis would argue that you can't really, and we're going to get into this, you can't really embrace the Christian faith until you have a sense of it beyond it being just concepts. It needs to enter into your world, into your real world, right? A lot of that was what Dr. Ross was doing earlier. He's saying, hey, here's the physical world. This seems to be pointing to God. Well, Lewis believed that. He believed that we need to have real, our imagination be opened up to understand what Christianity might look like. And the Bible has the example of the Apostle Paul's conversion, but Lewis becomes another example of kind of a conversion, very similar to Augustine's own conversion in the sense that it was a journey back into his true deepest longings. So let's talk a little bit about Lewis's birth and childhood. Lewis was born in 1898 in Belfast, and he came from an educated Protestant family. His grandfather was a minister, his father was a lawyer, his mother was a mathematician. Lewis writes, there were books in the study, books in the dining room, books in the class in the cloakroom, books in the great bookcase on the landing, books in a bedroom, books piled as high as my shoulder in the cistern attic, books of all kinds. And if you've ever been to Ireland, you know it rains a lot. Okay? And so guess what Lewis did as a child? He was surrounded by books, and he was immersed in books, and he read a lot of books. Lewis's full name is Clive Staple Lewis, but when Lewis was five, his much-beloved dog, Jaxie, died. And when his pet died, he took on the name of his dog, Jaxie. He refused to be called anything else than Jaxie. Which is really interesting because if you know anything about Lewis's Chronicle of Narnia series, he has these animals that had this kind of human qualities. And in fact, as a boy, he loved to create stories where there are these animal people kind of things, right? There'd be like a mouse that was wearing a three-piece suit and all this stuff. So Lewis always had this kind of imaginative quality, but it eventually became shortened to Jack. And so he was also known as Jack, named after the dog. His brother Warney and him were lifelong friends and companions and playmates as children, and they lived in this profound world of imagination. But when Warney was seven, he was sent off to. When Lewis was seven, Warney was sent off to English boarding school, and Lewis became reclusive and again reading books, living in this imaginary world, writing stories, and illustrating his stories. In 1908, a very tragic thing happened 3 months before his 10th birthday. Lewis lost his mother to cancer, and this was a huge blow to Lewis. Now, his mother knew Lewis much better than the father, okay? The mother was invested. She had taught Lewis French and Latin and English, and sadly, his father was a little more removed. And then, when his mother died, this is very tragic, his father began falling apart. And his father became even more distant and didn't know what to do, which, I mean, you know, back in those days, I think a lot of men weren't expected to know how to raise a child, right? It was that kind of thing. So in many ways, Lewis not only lost his mother, but his father. As Lewis writes in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, many pleasures, many stabs of joy, but no more of the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis." There's this very touching scene in The Magician's Nephew, which is one of the books in the Chronicles of Narnia, where a little boy has an apple. It's a magic apple that can cure. And the witch says, go, give that to your mother, because his mother is dying. And the little boy is tempted but is obedient and brings the apple to Aslan, which he was supposed to do. And then Aslan says, take this to your mother. And what's touching about this is you can hear this older man in his 40s still attempting to wrestle with the trauma he experienced with his mother passing away. Lewis was sent to boarding school in England because dad didn't know what to do. And so he was abandoned in many ways, but this is not unusual. People were sent to boarding schools, but Lewis hated it. Lewis actually, in his book, Surprised by Joy, calls this chapter Concentration Camp. And the first boarding school is named Belsen, which there's an actual concentration camp called Bergen-Belsen. And the first one he went to, there was a series of boarding schools. The first one was a small school. They only bathed them once a week. The headmaster, who was the kids called Oldie, was terribly abusive. In fact, the boarding school ended up getting shut down because of his abuse. And Lewis would beg his father to remove him from this school. Lewis writes, "Life at a vile boarding school is good preparation for the Christian life. It teaches one to live by hope, even in a sense by faith. For at the beginning of each term, home and the holidays are so far off that it is hard to realize them as to realize heaven." Lewis ended up in another boarding school called Cherbourg House. He began losing his faith to this school matron. She was kind of into the cult, kind of into spiritism, just a very fuzzy thinker. Lewis began questioning his faith. And then he went to another boarding school, got a scholarship there. He hated it. It was really competitive. It wasn't academic at all. It was all about athletics and social competition. And Lewis just didn't like that at all. And then he was begging his father, finally, if he could go and study with the tutor that had trained his father and his brother, Mr. Kirkpatrick, who is called the Great Knock. That was the title that him and his brother and his father had for him. So Lewis then is sent to Surrey, which is a suburb of London, to study with the Great Knock. The Great Knock was an interesting guy. He had been a Presbyterian. He was ordained, but he had walked away from his faith, and he was an atheist. And it's really underneath the Great Knock that Lewis begins to develop his atheism. His atheism begins to take shape. There's this really great thing about the Great Knock. The Great Knock was, you know, this is now in a period where it's the height of modernism, okay? There's a movement called logical positivism, which is the idea that if something can't be sensed with the five senses and logically diced out, it doesn't exist, right? And the problem with logical positivism, which was pointed out in the middle of the 20th century, is that logical positivism cannot be sensed with the five senses and proven logically, right? So the very philosophy itself doesn't hold to its own standards. But this was the period when people were buying into this, right? And the Great Knock was the ultimate example of this kind of like rigorous rationalism. And there's this great scene where Lewis walks off I don't know what it is, it's if he's at the train station, but he meets the Great Knock. And he says, wow. I'm surprised by the scenery in Surrey. It's wilder than I expected. So he's trying to make small talk here as a boy. And the Great Knock says, stop! Lou says, stop, shouted Kirk with a suddenness that made me jump. What do you mean by wildness? And what grounds had you for not expecting it? And this was the beginning of this kind of very rigorous, everything you said, you had to be able to defend. And Lewis writes, some boys would not have liked it. To me, it was red beef and strong beer. Lewis was no teetotaler. He says, I loved the treatment. After being knocked down sufficiently often, I began to know a few guards and blows and to put on intellectual muscle. So the great knock is really should be credited for helping Lewis know how to think very carefully and to be able to defend himself. And in fact, when Lewis would later lead the Oxford Socratic Club, a lot of the really intense kind of dialogue that involved clear and concise thinking, he could credit to the training he had under the great knock. But he also received a very kind of virulent form of atheism while he was studying with him. Lewis then writes to his best friend Arthur Greaves around this time, I believe in no religion. There's absolutely no proof for any of them. And from a philosophical standpoint, Christianity is not even the best. All religions, that is, all mythologies, to give them their proper name, are merely man's own invention. So this is the young Lewis, who is about 16 and getting ready to head off to college. Lewis the young man. Lewis won a coveted scholarship to Oxford and arrived in Oxford on April 26, 1917. And this is important because Lewis, in many ways, never really leaves Oxford, right? He does have a post at Cambridge, but he comes home to Oxford on the weekend. The only exception is when he serves in World War I as a soldier. But Lewis there comes to Oxford, and immediately, you know, so 1917, World War I has been going since 1914, and Lewis has it within him that he wants to, once he gets old enough, be a part of serving. Being in the service. And so he immediately joins the officers' training club. And while he's there, he ends up finding himself rooming with a young Irishman named Paddy Moore. And Paddy Moore, his mother, Janie Moore, was 45, and Paddy had a sister named Maureen, and they lived near Keble. And remember, Lewis kind of was a homeless guy, right? I mean, his mother died, his father kind of abandoned him. So in many ways, Lewis is looking for home. And this family, the door was always open. And even though he only connected with them for a short time that year, this family became extremely important. And Lewis and Paddy end up making a promise to each other that should they go off to war and one of them die, that they would take care of the other person's family. Okay, so this will end up proving important. On September 25th, 1970, Lewis was placed into the 3rd Somerset Light Infantry. He arrived November 29th, 1917, in the trenches of France. And there he began to see the horrors of war. World War I was horrible, right? It was just a horrible war. Lewis writes, I've gone to sleep marching, woken and found myself still marching. The fright, the cold, the smell of high explosive, the landscape of sheer earth without a blade of grass, the horribly smashed men still moving like half-crushed beetles. So there he actually kept a diary, and he also wrote in the trenches. Lewis could just write anywhere, any place, anytime. He had that kind of mind. Lewis had some atrocious experiences there. The sergeant that had saved his life was blown up right next to him. I mean, just the kind of stuff that you can imagine he saw. In April of 2018, he was hit. He says, I was hit in the back of the left hand, on the leg from behind, above the knee, and in the armpit with shrapnel. And so he was out of the war. Back at Oxford, eventually convalescing. And so he was back at Oxford in 1919, and true to his word, because his friend Paddy Moore had died, he moved in with Mrs. Moore and her daughter Maureen, and it was his first attempt to kind of find home. And in fact, the three of them referred to each other as the family. All right, so Lewis then takes a series of firsts, and that's what you call when you score really well on your studies, and he had 3 firsts, and he graduates successively in these firsts, and then he begins as a philosophy tutor. And then he was elected as a fellow in English at Magdalen College. And he actually ended up teaching both English and philosophy at Magdalen. And so Lewis now has become a tutor. So this is Lewis, the young scholar, and he is an atheist. He's a tutor in English and philosophy at Magdalen. Now, Lewis's conversion is so fascinating. And I don't know how many of you have ever read it in Surprised by Joy. Okay, Joy is really kind of the motif behind his whole life. But it's so fascinating. You know, Lewis is living during a time when Freud is huge, okay? Freud was born 40 years, give or take, before Lewis. And so by the time Lewis and his colleagues come on the scene, it's all about Freud. It's arguable that Freud is still one of the most important philosophers today. When you have conversations with people, we'll get into that later when we talk about ethics. But Lewis ends up spending an incredible amount of time kind of dealing with his atheism and trying to work it out. Now, Lewis has these designs of being a poet. He wants to be a poet. And Lewis actually got his first poem published his first year at Oxford as a freshman, not bad. And then he had this long narrative poem called Dimer. And in Dimer, it's a place where we see him expressing his atheism with a Freudian bent. He writes, "The Christian dream, as we called it, was the hidden enemy whom we were all determined to unmask and defeat. My hero, therefore, had to be a man who had succumbed to its allurements and finally go the better of them. By the time I wrote Dimer, I had come under the influence of our common obsession about Christian dreams into a state of angry revolt against that spell." Christianity was seen as juvenile by Lewis, and belief in God seemed to be a tempting illusion that people must resist if they're going to be cold, hard thinkers that deal with the reality of life. Sound familiar? That's the Great Knox. But this doesn't work for Lewis. And the reason it doesn't work is really kind of amusing. I mean, not everybody's life is interesting, but Lewis's life is really interesting. That's why there's so many movies that have been made about his life, okay? And one of the things that's so fascinating is that here's Lewis, this cold, hard atheist, but he's not drawn to other atheists. It's not who he likes. He finds himself with this perplexing problem. All of his favorite authors are Christians. He writes, "All the books were beginning to turn against me. George MacDonald had done more to me than any other writer. Of course, it was a pity he had that bee in his bonnet about Christianity. He was good in spite of it. Chesterton had more sense than all the other moderns put together, batting, of course, his Christianity. Johnson was one of the few authors whom I felt I could trust utterly. Curiously enough, he had the same kink. Spencer and Milton, by strange coincidence, had it too. On the other hand, those writers who did not suffer from religion and with whom, in theory, my sympathy ought to have been complete, all seemed a little thin. What as boys we called tinny. It wasn't that I didn't like them. They were all entertaining, but hardly more. There seemed to be no depth in them. They were too simple. The roughness and density of life did not appear in their books." Note his disappointment. His disappointment is with a secular vision, which doesn't deal with the roughness, the depth of life, right? I mean, what is secularism? Secularism literally means of an age. It means to be reduced down to one particular dimension, right? One particular kind of perspective where there's nothing outside of it. To be a Christian is someone, it requires imagination. You need to get outside of the way in which you kind of think. And Lewis is all about the imagination. Remember, he has a tremendous imagination. And so Lewis loves these imaginative authors, and they all happen to be Christians because they have this capacity to deal with life in a way that just rings true for Lewis. But it wasn't just the authors that were turning on Lewis. Lewis's favorite people were Christians too. He writes about going into this one tutorial. "I went to George Gordon's discussion class, and there I made a new friend. The very first words he spoke marked him out from the 10 or 12 others who were present, a man after my own heart, and that too at an age when the instantaneous friendship of earlier youth were becoming rather rare events. His name was Neville Coghill. I soon had the shock of discover that he, clearly the most intelligent and best-informed man in that class, was a Christian and a thoroughgoing supernaturalist. So Lewis is like, this doesn't make sense. So Lewis's favorite colleagues as an Oxford Don were scholars such as Owen Barfield and J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. In fact, he and Owen Barfield spent night after night, as Lewis says, in hammer and tongs, going at it. And Barfield, he's like, I thought I was going to convince Barfield I needed to set about and deconstruct his Christianity. And then when I started doing that, I realized he actually was doing that to me. He thought I was lost. Like, what? And so here he is. And slowly the influence of these Christians begin to get to Lewis. And they have good arguments. And he needs to start giving it attention. And then he writes, I love this. I felt as if I were a man of snow at long last beginning to melt. The melting was starting in my back, drip, drip, and presently trickle, trickle. I rather disliked the feeling. he talks about, at this stage of his life, his atheism was like a coat of armor that was kind of keeping him secure, but in many ways also kind of stifling him. And then he starts feeling Christianity dislodging him. He talks about his conversion in terms of like a fox. He says, the fox had been dislodged from Hegelian wood and was now running in the open with all the woe in the world, bedraggled and weary, hounds barely a field behind. And nearly everyone was now, one way or another, in the pack. Plato, Dante, MacDonald, Herbert, Barfield, Tolkien, Dyson, even joy itself. See, so he's being chased now in many ways. Well, his conversion didn't happen in one foul swoop. He actually had a two-part conversion. The first was a step to theism and then to Christianity. He writes, in the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night the most dejected, reluctant convert in all of England. It wasn't a happy conversion. It really wasn't. See, if God is God, then he knew that he wasn't. He knew that he couldn't live life on his own terms, and it was a joyless conversion. He really started to feel his shortcomings, his flaws, his impatience, his lack of charity. He became aware that he should love other people like he loved himself. He began to kind of develop, you know, basic moral awareness of what it means if there is a God, and yet he didn't know how Christ fit into this yet, and he wasn't convinced that Christianity, of all the religions, was the best way to worship this supernatural being. He believed there was a God, but he had no specific way to worship God. He was attracted to other religions. He liked Hinduism. He thought that was interesting. He liked Christianity too, both of them, but he had no way to ferret out which one he should go for, and so he was joyless. And so this is the second step of his conversion. He was reading G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man. Anybody ever read Everlasting Man? That is a great book. That is a great book. Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton, which talks about how the history of the world leads up to the incarnation. And he said, quote, he saw the whole Christian outline of history set out in a form that seemed to actually make sense to me. Now, during this time, this is another thing that jarred. There's a series of things that just kind of start jarring him at this time. He was talking to one of his friends who's an atheist, okay, who he really trusted. And so he's on the team, right? Or he was on the team of atheism. And this atheist says, you know, I've been studying the historical data for the resurrection, and I don't know what to do with this. It looks like the thing might have happened. And Lewis is like, not you. Like, of all the people, not you. You're the only safe person around here. He starts reading the New Testament in Greek because, you know, he's a classicist. And immediately he realizes that this is not myth. He knows what myth is. He's a specialist in myth. He understands how myth works. But the Gospels were a set of stories that had a certain historicism to them. They were somehow giving the kind of things he loved in myth. He loved the idea of a God dying and rising. He loved the idea of people being purified, right? He loved these kind of pieces of other myths that he also associated with Christianity. But when he picked up the Gospels, he said, this is weird. This is something that's both myth and history. How can that be? He writes, they had not the mythical taste, and yet the very matter which they set down was precisely the matter of the great myths. If ever a myth had become fact, had been incarnated, it would be just like this. And nothing else in all literature was just like this. Myths were like it in one way, histories were like it in another, but nothing was simply like it. and no person was like the person it depicted. Okay, so you had these kind of things happening, but his true conversion to Christianity, not just theism, didn't happen until September 19th, 1931. That night, Lewis had a very important discussion with Owen Barfield and J.R. Tolkien. He invited them over, and it lasted till 4 a.m., and they talked about myth. And Tolkien, in particular, kind of led the conversation. The subject was the common nature of religious mythology and why Christianity should be considered different. And after all, I mean, pagan myths, as we said, had a capacity to profoundly tap into our psyches. That's why they had captured people. But Tolkien said at one point, of course these myths touch us because they are refractions of Christianity, which is the one true myth. And for the first time, something, a light bulb goes on for Lewis, right? And so this sits with him. And it sits with him for about 9 days. And this is the best. This is the best thing. So how does Lewis actually end up becoming a Christian? He gets on a ride to the zoo with his brother Warney. He goes on a ride, and he does nothing. He does nothing. Lewis talks about the dragons of the mind, that oftentimes the dragons of the mind keep truth from coming in, and sometimes you have to release the dragons in order for the truth to come in. That's why he wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, which is this laden, it puts you into this other world where all of your defenses are let go, and then these theological truths come to you, right? So that's why Lewis does theological fiction. Well, this is what happened to his conversion. He writes this: I know very well when, but not hardly how, the final step was taken. I was driven to Whipsnade one sunny morning. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And we reached the zoo, I did. Very Lewis-esque, right? Like I don't know how it happened. I don't know. I just was on a ride. All right. Let's talk a little bit about what happened. You know, so when Lewis converts, Lewis had set out to be a poet. Right, and his poetry was, you know, so received. Okay, he was able to get some poetry published, and he was considered a poet, but it didn't really take off like he had hoped. That's what his dream had been, and now that he becomes a Christian, his literary focuses get shifted, and it takes off like big time. Right, I mean, in many ways, the same story with John Calvin. John Calvin was a Seneca scholar. He wrote this commentary with all these bells and whistles. Doesn't work out. He's going through Geneva, and next thing you know, the guy writes one of the most important theological treatises, the Institute. So there's some interesting parallels between Lewis and other historical figures. So Lewis becomes a Christian, and he's immediately within the set of friends. And this set of friends become known as the Inklings. Lewis and his dear friend J.R. Tolkien were at the core of this group. It included Neville Coghill, Hugo Dyson, Charles Williams, and others. And so they began, at first, it's actually, the Inklings actually comes out of a formal club that was at Oxford that became disbanded, but this group continued to meet and they adopted that name. And so early 1930s is when they began. We're not exactly sure when. It was very organic, you know. But they started meeting to gather, to talk, to drink, to read each other's works. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet, Charles Williams' All Hallows Eve were among some of the novels that were read at the Inklings. But meetings weren't just seriousness. The meetings also were fun. Sometimes they would take someone they considered a really bad poet and see how they could read their poetry really bad. there was a lot of fun and merriment, as Lewis would say, that took place at these meetings. Lewis writes, "My happiest hours are spent sitting up to the small hours in someone's college room talking nonsense. Poetry, theology, metaphysics, you know, nonsense. Over beer, tea, and pipes. There's no sound I like better than adult male laughter." Metaphysics, nonsense, that's just funny. Metaphysics is heavy lifting, so. If you go to the Eagle and Child in Oxford, there's a plaque actually at the place where they used to meet, and you can sit there and have a drink and, you know, imbibe Lewis, I guess. We're Protestants, we don't do pilgrimage, but, you know, we won't call it that. But in many ways, I think that what's interesting here is there's a story for us, and that's this. This is a group of Christians that are in a culture that is heavy scientism, heavy rationalism. And they get together and they mutually encourage and support each other such that they're able to have a huge impact, right? And so solo Christianity has, if you do a study on church history, you'll find time and time again, the people that have had a huge impact didn't do it alone. they pulled together. I mean, I think about like Wilberforce, who was, I think he shared backyards with Wesley. And I mean, there's always been this, you pull together. And so that's what's happening. There's this kind of creativity as these Christians pull together in the 1930s, where modernism is just sweeping away. If something can't be proven with a scientific method, then it's just thrown out. And these Inklings were a resistance group, and they decide that they're going to develop their writings in a distinctly Christian way. Lewis and Tolkien decide that the kind of stories they want to have written are not being written. So what they do is say, well, why don't we do this? Somebody writes a time story and somebody writes a space story, and they flipped a coin. And so so Tolkien got the time story, and he wrote Lord of the Rings, and Lewis got the space story, and he wrote his science fiction trilogy. So that's kind of how that went down. Lewis set out to be a great poet, but then, as I said before, he actually ends up becoming this great apologist. And probably the work he's best known for is Mere Christianity. So I just want to say a little bit about that. World War II was a hard time. And London was being bombed, and children were being evacuated, because parents were concerned. So the government organized this thing where children would be sent out to the countryside. And Lewis received 4 children at the kilns. And you can imagine Lewis is this older bachelor, right? And it was just a joy to have these 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, come to the kiln and wander around and be kind of in just amazed, because they're coming from London. And the kilns, you're not out in the woods, but, I mean, it's probably like, they thought they were at a farm. They thought they were out in the middle of nowhere, right? And there's a pond not nearby and all that. So so then, in fact, one day, this one girl comes up to a wardrobe and says, "What's that? And what's behind that?" So if you've read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you're seeing where this goes, right? And that's why it's really nice to know about someone's life. No one does scholarship ex nihilo. No one is just a brain on a stick. Right? We're all living lives. Every person you talk to, when they ask a question, they're usually asking that question because they have some kind of experience behind it that's generating that. So when you read Lewis about his life, you start seeing all this stuff coming together. Well, the same thing's true for Mere Christianity. Mere Christianity didn't just drop out of the sky where Lewis sat in his office. People were in desperate situations. People were huddled in shelters, and people would turn to the radio to listen to what is happening with the war. And bombs are dropping, people are dying, trauma's happening, and people are wondering, where is God in the midst of all of this? And so the director of religious programming at the BBC asked Lewis to give some talks on faith. Lewis was reluctant. He didn't like to leave home. He's kind of a homebody. He hadn't done any radio work. He just didn't know about this whole situation. But the producer said he promised him it'd only be 5 to small, 15 minutes each. And so Lewis wrote these 5 talks to encourage people. And it was so successful that the BBC was flooded with people begging them to bring Lewis back on the radio. And so he's called back for 5 more, and then 5 more. And then, these were grouped together, okay, into 3 different books. And then eventually they become combined into Mere Christianity. And this word, Mere Christianity, is really important. We'll get into this when we talk about Lewis as a theologian. Lewis very wisely set out with the idea that he wanted to focus on the majors. He didn't want to be known for a particular denomination. He didn't want to be known as an Anglican or as a Congregationalist, though it's great to be a Congregationalist, great to be an Anglican. He wanted to be known as a mere Christian. He'll leave those more detailed issues to other people. That wasn't his. Also, the same thing with politics. Lewis was invited by Churchill to have a very significant post, and Lewis turned it down because he said, "I don't want people to read my work through the lens of politics. I don't want to be bipartisan. I've got bigger fish to fry," which there's kind of a story for us today in America, isn't there, for Christians, right?
Yeah.
So Lewis didn't want to be known as a particular, that he was owned by one particular Christian tradition. And so he talked about mere Christianity, that which the church has always held up, the essentials of the faith. That's what he wanted to be invested in defending, is this mere Christianity. And I would say that if you haven't read Mere Christianity and you're going to read one book as a result of this class, I would recommend Mere Christianity. It does theology, it does ethics, and it also deals with the Christian life in a way that's devotional and rich. It's also a great book to hand to someone that isn't a believer. All right, a couple things I want to mention before we wrap it up. and take some questions. By 1950s, Lewis had become famous. You know, he published like crazy in the 40s, and he was a content bachelor. There's no reason for him to think that he would ever get married. And then Joy Davidman, a novelist and poet from a Jewish background who was an atheist and had embraced the Christian faith, wrote him and said, you know, my conversion in part was due to your writing. And Lewis was an eligible bachelor. I mean, he had lots of women writing him, okay? It wasn't like the guy, no one liked him, you know, of course, right? He's a very public figure now. He's popular. He'd already been, by 1950, already been on the cover of Time magazine, right? But there was something different about this woman. She was his equal. She was a novelist. She was a poet. She was someone that could see, like, someone that he deeply respected. And they kind of got each other. And so their love story is amazing. There's actually a movie about it if you want to check it out. It's really something special. We won't be able to get into it right now. But there's a really funny thing to it, which is she was in a situation where she needed a green card to stay, and Lewis married her just for the green card. He's like, well, I'm never going to get married anyways, so well, I'll marry you, and that way you can get out of your situation, your legal situation. And then once they're married, they start to fall in love. It's very touching. And while they're falling in love, she contracts bone cancer, which is very, very heartbreaking. And so, and he knows he wants to marry her. So he calls a minister friend to the hospital, and he says, I will very soon become a groom and a widower. And that's how much he loved her. Isn't that beautiful? She's so beautiful. And after they did the marriage part of the ceremony, the minister laid hands on her and prayed for her healing. And I mean, she was like in extreme pain. They thought she only had a few days. Lewis thought she's about to die. And crazy, like she went into remission. Part of her hip bone grew back. I mean, the doctor's like, what is going on here? And so they had this wonderful time where they had were able to go to Greece, which was always her dream, and travel together. And it was a beautiful thing. But eventually her cancer returned, and she died in 1960. And then Lewis wrote a book about this called A Grief Observed. It's where he's chronicling his grief, and it's gritty. It's real. This is something I like about Lewis. Lewis is a real person. And in this book, like Job, he you know, there's parts where he just lashes out at God, like the Psalms of Lament, right? The imprecatory Psalms. Lewis is grappling with, you know, here's the great apologist. And yet when personal suffering comes into his life, he's just like all the rest of us, struggling with God. Why did you take, why? He's like, God, why would you pull me out of my shell as a bachelor at the end of my life to finally meet the love of my life only to take her? Like, what is the plan here, God? Very moving and very touching book. And he's working through it. He doesn't lose his faith, but he's working through, he's struggling with God. Lewis doesn't live much longer. 3 years later, he himself dies, so he, you know, maybe heartbreak might have contributed to that, right? You have that thing where one person dies and the other person is not long after. So that is, and interestingly enough, this is an interesting fact, but Lewis died 1963, I believe, the same day that JFK and Aldous Huxley died. So, and actually I've heard a talk before where it compares the three different worldviews of those people, right? And talks about how one's a humanist and one's an atheist and one's a Christian. But all right, so that is a little bit about Lewis's life, and I want to highly recommend this book. It's called Surprised by Joy, and when we talk about Lewis and his argument from desire, this book will also play back into that. Lewis saw his entire Christian journey as one of pursuing joy. And another book, if you're interested, if you've already read this one, Lewis, shortly after becoming a Christian, I think it might have been the first one. I can't see, you guys took my stuff. But I think it was this book here. Let's see here. Yeah, The Pilgrim's Regress, after his conversion, was the first book in which he maps his intellectual journey to Christianity. And it's an allegory, so it ends up, he goes to, He goes to the land of thrill. It's really interesting. And he ends up mapping the soul as a result of it and talking about the way in which belief corresponds to different parts of the human person. So it's also very fascinating, the Pilgrim's Regress. So let me just say a little bit about this little map I gave you right here. And I only made 75. There's just too many people here. But I'm happy to make some more, and I'll have those next week so you don't feel like you're missing out. But I wanted you to see in chronological order just kind of Lewis's output. I want to draw your attention to a couple things here. The first is that you can see starting in 1939, Lewis's production just goes just bonanza, right? You can also see that all the different kinds, and some of these actually, I didn't even know what genres to call them. A lot of Lewis's work kind of fits between different genres, right? Is it theology? Is it fiction? Is it children's literature? What is this? And that was Lewis's genius, is that he could do really high-level academic stuff, and he could speak to children, and he could go in between. One of the books we're going to recommend is The Abolition of Man. That's one of the recommendations when we do The Ethics of Lewis. And that's a great example of, he has a very profound argument in that book about moral relativism, and yet it's written in a very simple way. So he had that capacity. So the genre, it gives you an example of the genre. It also gives you an example of different things you can put together. Like, for instance, Mrs. Moore dies, and then he meets Joy Gresham. So Mrs. Moore was one of his life companions, right? And a surrogate mother in many ways, right? And as soon as she dies, then there's maybe this new open space, right, for a new companion. So you kind of see some of those things going on. You see the relationship between his father dying and his conversion. And a lot of Lewis scholars try to draw attention to that there seems to be something happening where he had to almost kind of reconcile with his own mortality at that point. But then you also see, look over in the second half, you see where Lewis dies and the books just keep coming. Lewis, there's a lot going on here. Lewis wrote so much, and these are just his books. We're not looking at all of his articles, and I mean, he wrote so much. And so what's happening is a lot of the stuff he's written that wasn't published was then being put together. Sometimes they'd add stuff that had already been published into these collected works and get themes. And they just keep going. And in fact, if you look down at the end, I have like a dot, dot, dot. That just means that there's a section there where I lost track and we can't fit them all on the page. I put two really important ones at the end there, the collected letters of C.S. Lewis, which is a giant three-volume set that came out not too long ago. And then the Latin letters of C.S. Lewis came after that, which goes to show you, just when you think you've covered all the letters, like, oh, wait, he wrote them in Latin too, so let's get a book on that. So just get used to Lewis books coming out kind of indefinitely, right? And he's the author, but he just wrote so much, and it was released in so many different ways that sometimes, you know, one essay is in one book and not in the other, and in all of that. Okay, a quick word about how we're going to spend our time, and then we will go to questions. Does that work?
Yeah, how long do you want to run till, probably?
Till noon.
Okay, we're going to go to noon, and if people could wait for this mic to ask questions, and please stand up so everyone can hear it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take questions, and then I'll talk about where we're going to go in terms of the reading. So let's go ahead, and we'll do Q&A.
Any questions? All right, Norm.
You mentioned that that Lewis didn't lose his faith, but you stopped there. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, at the death of his wife, mm-hmm. in his grief. Mm-hmm. So what happened?
Well, Lewis is very real about how his, you know, this is, remember, Lewis is living during a time where Freud is huge, and being able to map your own internal workings, which is one of the great joys about reading Lewis, is he's a profound psychologist in many ways. He has great insight into the workings of our internal lives, and he notices things during this time, like, you know, ask me to believe in the truth of my faith, I believe it. Ask me, you know, believe in the defensibility of my faith, I believe it. Ask me to believe in the consolation of my faith right now. I don't know what to do with that. You know, so so you can see him almost deconstructing and reconstructing his faith. Remember, it's really interesting because there's almost a book in his life. His mother dies when he's a boy, and that results in his atheism. And it's at the end of his life, he meets the next most significant woman in his life. And when she dies, it's like he has to recapitulate his atheism, but he comes out with a different answer. And at the end, there's a section in the Grief Observer where he says, you know, I woke up and I realized that the sun was kind of shining still, and there was almost a gift of her, you know, like he was able to start seeing the gift, that this was a gift. And even though he lost her, that he couldn't deny the gift. In many ways, that was one of the themes that she brought out, right? That the pain we have is inseparable from the joy we have. And so he starts moving towards recognizing that there's a joy here that is ultimately to lead me to God. And that's one of Lewis's whole themes, is that it's an Augustinian theme, which is the pleasures and the beauties and the joys in this world are signposts. They're signposts that are meant to point us upward and onward to our true home and the source of all joy. And so Lewis gets back on that Augustinian path and is able to celebrate that joy, recognize the loss, but in many ways recognize that it's a foretaste to that greater joy. So I don't know if I've done that justice, but that's what comes to mind. Yeah.
Do you recommend any books that where she wrote about Mormonism? I know the Mormon religion quotes him a lot.
I don't know of him writing about Mormonism. That doesn't mean he didn't, but I'm not aware. I'm not sure how big Mormonism was over in England during his time. England, you know, they like tea. And so I really can't answer that question. I wish I could. So I'm sorry. But, you know, I might have some resources if you want to talk afterwards. I might have some resources that could be helpful with that. Thank you for that question.
Bob, you cited a passage in which C.S. Lewis was unable to explain how he came to his faith at that particular time. Was there a time later on where he described that process years later?
Not the particular transition. He does get, before that, he goes into, when he converts to theism, he talks about this experience he has where he realizes he has a choice before him. And he realizes that he has this kind of freedom. And he knows that the scariest thing to do is to leave behind the comfort he has, because it'll feel like, and then that's where I had that quote about the snowman and the fox, like it would feel very unsafe. And he very intentionally, and he talks about also a time when, during this time, he talks about he becomes extremely aware that it's like he is pushing something away from himself. And so he brings up all these different themes in his conversion to theism, but when it comes to his conversion to Christianity, yeah, he has these intellectual pieces, but at the end of the day, he just says, it just happens. I mean, I've had something very similar happen to me, where I was meeting with a mentor, and I had all this theological language, but it was dead to me, and I was a pastor at a church, and I'm like, none of this, I don't care. I know all the answers, but this has no traction. I started meeting with a mentor and digging through and sifting through my life and just a lot of tears and whatnot. And then one day I woke up and I'm like, wow, I believe all this stuff and I don't know how I got here. And I think what Lewis is getting at is that our organs for belief are always bigger than reason and logic, that there's something that happens at a level of the imagination and at the aesthetic level that is inescapable and almost unchartable. It would be a really interesting study and I'm sure it's been done, there's so many dissertations on Lewis, but to dissect Lewis's understanding of the will and how the will comes to a place of choice, you know? It's very fascinating. And when he goes into those sections, you can tell he knows all the philosophical and theological real estate that's for sale as he's giving very personal accounts of his own struggling with coming to faith. So, yeah.
Thanks for mentioning the word secularism. To me, it's been a watershed word that has sometimes left me feeling, as a religious person, in a ghetto from rationality. The Welsh hodel is, I think, the diluted word for age or this earth. And I like to feel like, as a religious person, part of this earth. I'm wondering if you could consider maybe some of the history. I think in 1851, George Holyoake coined the word as to be independent from religion. And when I hear that, he didn't say against religion, but it's always that religion is left out in the cold.
Yeah.
And yet Barry Kaufman later, he's part of the Institute for the Study of Secularism in Society and Culture, divided it into hard and soft, that gave some hope. I wonder what you think about this. That he said hard secularism is indeed considering religion as epistemologically illegitimate. And so it's taken that extra step, not just independent.
Mm-hmm.
But soft secularism realizes that we are not omniscient. We can't make a claim to absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
We must be tolerant and allow rationality to be both in religion and outside of religion. So
mm-hmm.
I'd like to feel like I'm part of this world in this age.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great question. I'd love to come back and teach on secularism and secularization, which is one of my areas of specialization. By the way, my understanding of paradox is like it's all questions are game. So it doesn't have to be a Lewis question, even though this kind of came up in the talk. Let me just say this. When I hear the word ism attached to a word, I feel uncomfortable because it communicates a certain kind of commitment. There always has been the idea of the secular. Which is that there is something that is common, and then the sacred, right? Which is uncommon. That's a very Christian concept. It comes out of Christianity, the idea of secular, that there's some things that we treat as common. But what the secular should be is a huge battlefield today. And the way it's defined will have massive implications for our society. So this is something that we should talk about sometime. But when I hear secularism, I hear ism. And an ism is something where you set something up and you give it a certain kind of sphere of influence in which it becomes the dominating way of perceiving and of acting and of moving and of being, right? And so I would say as Christians, I'm glad that we have a society where we are principally pluralistic in the sense that we allow for multiple viewpoints. I think our society is like that as an outgrowth of Christianity. I don't know if you ever thought about that, but you know the fact that we don't, this is a congregational church. In fact, we don't have a state that forces one particular version of religion on people is the outgrowth of a Christian view of how the faith needs to be something that isn't just simply pushed down upon people, but something that they actually believe in. And so there's a certain principle pluralism, but that principle, when that principle is removed, then you start seeing different hegemonic groups fighting for the turf of society. And secularism, in my understanding, is the idea that you no longer can be a religious person in the public sphere. And that, to me, is a huge issue we need to talk about sometime, but it's extremely scary to me. It's a very scary idea. So.
A question from the audience online.
Yes, we have an online question. Carl would like to know, what are your thoughts on Lewis's interest in Wagner?
I don't know. I don't have any. I have no response to that. It's a great question. And as I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, yeah, I can remember this was this is a tributary of discussion, and it's an important question. But I don't have anything to say. I don't know. Good question.
Well, you described how his conversion was sort of like the melting snowman. And when I read Chronicles of Narnia, of course, that's the theme when the children go into the wardrobe, and it changes as Aslan becomes closer to the whole kingdom of Narnia. The snow begins to melt, and there's springtime happening. And I'm wondering, is that an allegory of what happened to him as far as faith coming into his life?
Yeah, you can hear it, can't you? You know, the cold heart. Right, coldness in Lewis always kind of symbolizes hardness, right? And in the I can't remember, it's the Four Loves where he says, You know, you can go ahead and not, and decide to keep yourself safe and never get attached to another human being, you know, but your heart then will just get locked up in a coffin and become cold and hard. And so coldness oftentimes for Lewis is symbolic of this kind of like a hardness, right? And so the thawing really is this idea of warming up, of love. Love is at the center of Lewis's ethics. We'll talk about that, right? And so love oftentimes we talk about, you know, passion and heat and, you know, all those kind of metaphors.
I hate to admit it, but I've tried Mere Christianity several times. And I have a difficult time reading them, and I have to go back and read paragraphs two or three times and say, what is he saying? So I just give up. Am I alone?
No. You're not alone, and this will have to be our last question. We'll have more time to talk later, but you're not alone. And so, and that actually is a great seg into where we're going. And it might not be for everybody. And there's different sections within Mere Christianity. He has a section where he talks about the virtues. And I think that's a little easier going. When he talks about pride, that's very devotional. And so, but some of it is a little bit, you know, where he's kind of turning some corners that are a little bit heavy lifting. So, this is what I want to recommend if you want to follow along. Next week, we're going to talk about Lewis the Theologian. If you want to read a book, I would recommend either The Great Divorce, which is a bus ride from hell to heaven. Yes, you heard that correctly. The Screwtape Letters, which is letters from a senior devil to a junior devil on how to trip somebody up. Or if you don't have time to read a whole book, you can read The Weight of Glory. I didn't bring it, but there's a little book called The Weight of Glory and Other Essays. And many people believe this is the finest sermon ever preached. You'll have to read it and find out. But it's very short, and it's just dense and thick and lovely. Week after that, we're going to do Lewis the Ethicist. And there, I'm recommending The Abolition of Man and The Four Loves. The Abolition of Man is probably a little easier than The Four Loves. And if you don't have very much time to read, then I'm recommending this book. If you're only going to get one book, and you're not going to read Mere Christianity, and you just want to kind of follow some of the readings, God in the Dock, Essays on Theology and Ethics. And there is an essay in here called The Laws of Nature. Okay. Week four, we're doing Lewis the Positive Apologist. And there we have Mere Christianity, we have Miracles. And again, an alternative reading here is called Miracles. Week five, we have Lewis the Negative Apologist. There we're going to do The Problem of Pain, A Grief Observed. And there's an alternative reading in here called Evil and God. And then finally, week six, we have Lewis the Writer. And you can Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Out of the Silent Planet. And an alternative is you can go online, and a lot of Lewis's poetry is found there. So, but I really hope that everybody here reads something of Lewis during this time, because he is just so lovely. And if you find heavy lifting in Mere Christianity, there's other stuff that will also get you there. So excellent. Well,
let's say thank you to Robert.
Thank you.